Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back once again. Sorry for that. Gremlins on my side, unfortunately. Allah make it easy for us all, inshallah. So welcome on the Sunday morning, a lovely Sunday morning, and you can feel the bite already in the mornings with a slight chill that's coming through early mornings. But that is what's expected at this time of the year. We're closing up towards winter now, and that's the reality. But alhamdulillah, for the last few years, we haven't had such cold winters. We've had very few days which were extremely cold, but other than that, we've had lovely weathers. And fantastic, we still have our sunshine, we still have our sunlight, alhamdulillah, unlike other places in the world, where when it comes to the certain seasons, you won't even get sunshine for months on end. We must make shukr to the Almighty Allah. We have people coming from all over the world to absorb the sun of South Africa, sunny South Africa, as they say. So alhamdulillah, we make shukr to the Almighty Allah for giving us that particular benefit, I would call it. I was just going through some articles and I came across one article that said the second best place in the world to live in is Canada. And I was surprised because of the weather being so cold, snowing and so on. But they say it's the second best country in the world. News 24 had it during the week and I was very, very much surprised. But anyway, what we'll do is we have got on schedule already to talk to the Canadian ambassador. We had them some time back before, but we'll talk to the ambassador again. There's a new ambassador that's coming, so we will talk to the ambassador of Canada also and find out why. Why is it the second best in the world? So let us see what right they're doing. But alhamdulillah, I've got some friends in Canada and talking to them also. Alhamdulillah, as far as the masjids are concerned, there is no issues with them. They've just opened up another masjid somewhere near Mississauga. They opened up another masjid also, and things are happening for Islam. There is tolerance as per some of the Muslims that I talk to, alhamdulillah. Allah make it easy and Allah keep it that way, inshallah. Now, I just wanted to find out, there's so many people that had asked me some time back and all regularly ask me, when are you going to Vietnam? We can join you to go with you to Vietnam, so you can show us Vietnam the way you've seen it. Now, I thought of it and there's something that I've got to do, so probably in May sometime, we will be going for a couple of days, probably about 5 to 7 days or so. And if it is so that you are interested in joining us, we can go together, then we can make it a trip together with, you know, whoever it is. Let us see how many people get together and we can probably go together and make a trip out of it. Just the southern side of it, you're looking at Saigon, you're looking at Nha Trang and probably Munich. So you're not looking at Halong Bay and Hanoi and up north, all those cities. Just the down south, visit just the local places. Nothing great not so much of time that's going to be occupied, because you're looking at, like I said, 7 days or so, which will be from one weekend to the next. There's something that I have to do, so we can probably just get together and probably just do it, because I'm not committed when I go there this time around, so we can probably do that and just show you around the places that we know best. So we'll show you around, especially going to Nha Trang, going to the coastal towns and cities. So if you are interested, please contact me. Let's see if we can put up a couple of people together and let's see if we can go and do an Islamic part of it. We go there, we'll probably go, we'll do it the halal way. As we know that halal is very, very difficult, as I always mention, halal is difficult in Vietnam. But we'll do it the right way, where we'll probably take food with us and we'll get the hotels involved where they can support us as far as getting our food sorted out at the hotels. So maybe that can assist, and we'll try and get all the buses and all that, or the kumbis and it organized from this idea. So let's see what we can do. So if you are interested, 072-786-5520, that's 072-786-5520, you may SMS me. And you may mail me as well on Mohammed, M-O-H-A-M-E-D, at globetrotting.co.za. That's Mohammed at globetrotting.co.za. Let's see if we can come up with something. If not, then we'll shelve it for another time. But let's see if we can do something, inshallah. Nothing so hard and fast about that. Now, we talk of different countries of the world, touring different countries of the world. The world is becoming smaller and smaller for tourists. Whenever you go, whenever you hear, you'll find that there's issues happening, especially going to the Middle East. And it's becoming an issue, where you have countries that you are freely allowed to go to, it's becoming very difficult. Perfect example, you're looking at Syria. There used to be tours, regular tours going into Syria. It's now, I think, difficult to go to Syria as a tourist. And also, there's so much that's been destroyed that were tourist attractions. So to go to Syria is now, I would say, almost not so interesting. If many people would still say, okay, we can go, yes, you can. But then unfortunately, you go there, then there's going to be questions, why are you going, reasons, does that, and lots of issues about that too. So as a tourist to go, that is now out. And then you have Iraq, which is now out completely. Libya is still okay, yes, you can go, but there's limitations. All this, as we can see, unfolding in front of us. Then you have Afghanistan. Used to be also a place you could go to, visit. Unfortunately, you know, it's difficult. So it's closing up, especially in that region, it's closing up. And we hope and pray, inshallah, that it doesn't happen in the Far East, and it doesn't happen in the Africas. You know, it mustn't happen such way it becomes so difficult, but we can see the direction these things, you know, all these difficulties are taking now. But Allah make it easy, inshallah. Allah make it easy for one and all, that if you do have intention, you may go for a good reason, inshallah. Allah make it easy for you to go. Now, today I just want to talk about Afghanistan. It used to be a place where we had lots of people that went to Afghanistan, that I know of as well. Went to Afghanistan, visited, toured freely, alhamdulillah, lovely, enjoyed themselves. Now, I want to bring about, and I want to talk to you about Afghanistan is the history of Afghanistan. Afghanistan from the beginning, from around 1700s. The reign of Afghanistan has, for much of history, been part of the Persian Empire. From time to time, it has been linked with the northern plains of India, is under the Kushan dynasty of the 2nd century AD. Very occasionally, as in the time of Mahmud al-Ghazni, it's more known as Mahmud of Ghazni, but Muhammad al-Ghazni, also say Muhammad al-Ghazni, it has existed as a kingdom approximating more closely to the modern borders of Afghanistan. The beginning of modern Afghanistan can be dated to 1747, when the Afghans in Nadir Shah's army returned home after his death. And their leader Ahmad Khan Abdali enters Kandahar and is elected king of the Afghans in a tribal assembly. And he takes the title Dur-e-Durran, meaning the pearl amongst the pearls, and changes the name of his tribe to Durrani. Ahmad Shah Durrani, as he is now called, has learned from Nadir Shah the profession of conquest. And he applies his skills with great success over about 25 years thereafter. The extent of his empire fluctuates according to the success of his ceaseless campaigns to protect his boundaries. But for much of his reign, Afghanistan extends from the Amu Darya in the north to the Arabian Sea, and from Herat to the Punjab. And Ahmad Shah wins from his people the title Baba, which means father. You know, like they call it the father, he's the father of the nation. So he won the title Baba. The throne in Afghanistan remained with Ahmad Shah's tribe, though much disputed between his descendants, until they were ousted from Kabul in about 1818. Dost Muhammad, which was from 1818 to about 1838, Kabul was then taken in 1818 by an Afghan tribe, the Barakzai, led on this at that particular time by Dost Muhammad, the 20th, but the most forceful of the 21 sons of the tribal chieftain. Civil war against supporters of the Durrani continued for several years until about 1826. The country is then safely divided between Dost Muhammad and some of his brothers. Dost Muhammad received the greatest share in a stretch from Ghazni to Jalalabad, which includes Kabul. And he soon became accepted as the leader of the nation, taking the formal title of Amir from 1837. He was then accepted in the role by foreigners as well as by the Afghan tribes. Now we can see there's been power struggles from then already. And Afghanistan's relationship with the foreign powers by then, it was a very, very important factor. And then since the time of Peter the Great, which was in the early 18th century, Russia has been interested in developing a direct link with India. That meant that the need for a friendly or a puppet regime in Afghanistan. So this was already a plan before that.
the idea of the Russian influence in the region, the only neighboring territory with easy access to Britain's Indian Empire, inevitably rings alarm bells in London. And Dost Muhammad found himself courted by both sides, the British as well as the Russian. A British mission who was in Kabul in about 1837, while discussions are underway, the Russian envoys arrive at the same time, and they were also received by the Amir. The British immediately broke off negotiations, and then they were ordered to leave Kabul. The response of the Governor General of India, Lord Auckland at the time, was forceful, but in the event extremely unwise. He used the rebuff as a pretext for an invasion of Afghanistan in 1838, with the intention of restoring a ruler from the Durrani dynasty. That's the Shah Shuja on the throne from 1803 to 1809, who has shown himself to be more malleable. And this is the first of the three occasions on which the British attempt to impose their political will on Afghanistan. All three attempts at the time proved disastrous. In December 1838, a British army was then assembled in India for an Afghan campaign. And by April 1839, after a difficult advance under the constant harassment from tribal guerrillas, the city of Kandahar is captured, and then the Britons chose their own ruler. They put their ruler in place, and it was Shah Shuja. And he is crowned in a masjid there. 4 months later, Kabul was taken and Shah Shuja was crowned again. So now they've got their ruler, they've got their men in place. That's how it was done. And by the end of about 1840, the rightful Amir, which was Dost Muhammad, he was a prisoner of the British. He and his family, they were sent into exile into India. But the British garrisons in Afghan towns, they found it increasingly difficult to control these proud tribesmen. They were up in arms at the foreign intrusion in their affairs. So that became a problem. And in January 1842, the British garrison of some 4,500 troops withdrew from Kabul, leaving Shah Shuja to his own fate. And there, he was assassinated. Most of the retreating British and Indian soldiers, they were also killed during their attempt to regain the safety of India. And then, there's still quite a bit. I started off here during that time, just to show you what Afghanistan was like at that time. I want to come closer to the time up until 1960s, 70s and the 80s, and then the 90s, obviously. And thereafter, you know the history of Afghanistan. I want to bring about the awareness of what Afghanistan was and what Afghanistan is. So you've got that in your mind, what a country Afghanistan was. And we can visit Afghanistan. It is not a totally no-no place. You can visit Afghanistan, inshallah. We will continue right after the news.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back. If you just joined us, you're listening to myself, Muhammad Lambat, on Radio Islam, Medium Wave 1548, on the Globe Trotting program. If you're listening from South Africa and abroad, welcome to the program this morning, alhamdulillah. Welcome once again. We're talking Afghanistan. We're talking about the country Afghanistan in the 1800s. We're going to be talking about Afghanistan in the 1900s up to current. Afghanistan is a country to tour. Used to be an excellent place to go to. Many, many, many people from South Africa visited Afghanistan too. Unfortunately, it's become a bit difficult now because of the issues that are taking place. But we are going to continue talking Afghanistan. Just before we continue with that, I came across something so interesting. And it went out on social media and I picked it up on that. And I thought, let me just read it. It's something very short. But let me read it out for you where it's just something to ponder about. It's a king's portrait. Some of you must have read it already. It's a king's portrait. A king with a defect in one eye and in one leg asked all the painters to draw a beautiful portrait of his. A king who had a defect in one eye and in one leg asked all the painters in that area to draw a beautiful portrait of his. But no one was ready to draw as how to show him beautiful with a defect in one eye and a defect in the leg. It was difficult. Because he had the defect in his leg, because he had only one eye, how do you depict and how do you draw a picture of somebody like that? So it was difficult for some of the painters, and they said, no, we can't do it. However, one painter, he agreed, but he draws a classic picture. It was such a fantastic painting that everyone was shocked and surprised. That how could this painter draw something so great? What he painted was, he painted the king aiming for a deer in a hunt, targeting with one eye closed and a leg bent for the target. So picture that. Because he's got a defect in his leg, he showed that he was bending on that leg. And because he got a defect in the eye, he showed that the eye was closed, but he was aiming for the deer for that particular hunt. How brilliant. Why can't we, as insan, why can't we all paint others like this? We hide their weakness and highlighting their strengths. We do the opposite. Let us not show the weakness and hide the strengths. Let us hide the weakness and highlight their strengths. May we learn to hide other people's weaknesses and bring their virtues to light. Because unfortunately today life is such where one defect overshadows a million good of a human being. Something to ponder about. Anyway, let us continue with Afghanistan. Now we came to a point where in 1842 the British garrison of about 4,500 troops withdraws from Kabul. The British army now recaptures Kabul during the summer of about 1842, that same year again. More as a gesture of defiance than as a matter of practical policy. For the decision it is subsequently taken to restore Dost Muhammad to his throne when he returns from India in 1843 and rules peacefully without further British interference for another 20 years. He extends his territory by the end of his reign as far west as Herat. Dost Muhammad is succeeded by his third son, Sher Ali. After some years of bitter family feuding, it is Sher Ali's perceived leaning towards Russia, which again provokes British hostility. After such a long time, evoking memories of his father's offense in 1837, he welcomes a Russian mission to Kabul in 1878, and on this occasion even rejects a British mission. And in November 1878, three British armies push through the mountain passes into Afghanistan. They take Jalalabad and Kandahar by the end of the year and soon seem to have achieved everything they might wish for. A very advantageous treaty is agreed in May 1879 with Yakub Khan, the son of Sher Ali, who died in February. Under the treaty, Yakub Khan accepts a permanent British embassy in Kabul. Moreover, Afghanistan's foreign affairs are from that time on to be conducted by the British. But events soon prove that such a privilege can be dangerous in Afghanistan. And in September of that year, the British envoy to Kabul and his entire staff and escorted. They are then escorted and they are massacred. The disaster brings an immediate escalation of British military activity in Afghanistan. But to little political advantage, Yakub Khan is exiled to India also. And in his place, the British have to accept Abdul Rahman Khan, a rival grandson of Dost Muhammad, and the popular choice of the Afghan tribes as their Amir. And Abdul Rahman has spent, at that time, he spent 10 years in exile during the reign of his uncle Sher Ali, having been on the losing side in the bitter family war of succession. But his chosen place of exile does not chime well with the British interests. He has been in the Russian Empire in Samarkand, acquainting himself with the Russian methods of administration. And in 1880, Britain accepted Abdul Rahman as Amir of Kabul, agreeing at the time not to demand residence for a British envoy anywhere in Afghanistan. When British troops finally withdraw in 1881, having meanwhile helped Abdul Rahman again some rebellious cousins, the political achievement of two costly wars against Russian interference seems on the debit side of them. But at least Abdul Rahman proves to be an excellent Amir. And then he is followed on the throne by three generations of his family.
and he sets a pattern which they follow of an authoritarian regime dedicated to the introduction of technology and investment for more developed countries. Though the violence and anarchy of Afghan life often frustrate such modernizing intentions, Abdurrahman is succeeded in the year 1901. Now we're coming closer to the time here now. And he was succeeded in 1901 by his son Habibullah Khan, who successfully maintains a policy of strict neutrality during World War I. After the war, he demands international recognition of Afghanistan's full independence. And then that claim prompts Britain's third ineffectual intervention of Afghan affairs. Though it is Habibullah's son, Amanullah Khan, who had to deal with the crisis after his father was assassinated in 1919. And then a month of fighting between British and Afghan forces, it was inconclusive and rapidly leads to a treaty signed in Rawalpindi in August 1919, in which Britain acknowledges Afghanistan's independence as a nation. With that much achieved, Amanullah accelerates a program of reform on European lines, but in doing so, he alienates the old guard, and Amanullah is then forced into exile during an outbreak of civil war in 1929. Now, we're talking of Zahir Shah and Daoud Khan, that is between 1933 and as close as 1978. And in a reign of 40 years, Zahir Shah skillfully promotes Afghan interest. Once again, neutrality is successfully maintained during the next World War. And in the ensuing Cold War, Afghanistan brilliantly demonstrates the power of a non-aligned country to derive benefits from the major players on both sides. Both the USA and Soviet Russia, they build highways, hospitals, in a mood of superpower competition orchestrated by Zahir's cousin and brother-in-law, Daoud Khan. He was the prime minister from 1953. Daoud Khan then resigns in 1963. Because of tense relations with Pakistan, the border is then closed from 1961 until just after his resignation. His departure prompts Zahir Shah to attempt a major constitutional reform. And the constitution put in place in 1964 transforms Afghanistan in principle into a constitutional monarchy, excluding members of the royal family from political office and providing for an executive answerable to a legislative assembly of both the chambers. So now it's becoming a politically motivated place where you have the local families. It's becoming a tribal thing now. And we can see it's clearly Afghanistan was then becoming a tribal thing, a family issue, where the rulers are now taking from father to son to grandson and so on. So it's now becoming, I would call it a kingdom, like where you have the families coming in. But in 1965, and then in 1969 again, elections were held. At first the system seemed to have worked well, but soon thereafter there was friction between the king and the parliament. Now remember, it's a kingdom where there was open rulers, and now you have a parliament. So there was definite friction that took place, and a sense of political stalemate, which aggravated in the early 1970s, and there was a drought thereafter, and it brought famine and about 100,000 deaths. That was in about the 70s, and other economic difficulties, which was in 1973. Daoud Khan returned to power with military support in an almost bloodless coup, where Zahir Shah goes into exile in Europe as close as 1973. Daoud Khan came back into power now as a prime minister of the new Republic of Afghanistan with the help of the left-wing elements in the Afghan army, but he nevertheless tried to maintain a centrist policy, combining measures of reform at home with a broadly based foreign policy and less dependent on the USSR and Russia. And the USA, I would say, sorry. And in particular, he takes steps to mend fences with Pakistan, knowing that now he's obviously, it makes a difference. So he now tries to mend with Pakistan, become friends with them again. But in the perception of Afghanistan's radicals, he's drifting back towards the old royalist ways. A new constitution in 1977 promotes Dawood to the role of president. It also brings in what seemed as a cabinet of cronies, including some of his own royal relatives. And the result in 1978 was a violent revolution setting Afghanistan upon an entirely new course. Dawood's government is then overthrown, and he and most of his family they were then killed by a left-wing faction within the army. When the coup was complete, the officers hand over control to the nation's two leftist political parties. And the two parties are Khalq, which is the People's Party, and the Parcham, which is the Banner Party. The two are, for once again, working in harmony, though only for a brief period of time. Once in government, the two Khalq leaders, they seized power. Nur Muhammad Taraki becomes president and prime minister at the same time, with Hafizullah Amin as one of his two deputy prime ministers. The Parcham leader, and he's called Babrak Karmal, is the other deputy prime minister, but he's soon dispatched abroad as ambassador to Prague. And Taraki and Amin press ahead with a rapid program of reform along communist lines. And Afghanistan then became communist Afghanistan. Equal rights for women were then introduced. Land is then redistributed, all against the advice of Moscow, which favors a more cautious approach for fear of Muslim backlash. Meanwhile, the leaders of the Parcham Party, they are then persecuted and in several cases killed, many including Barak Karmal, who then take refuge in Russia. The Kremlin is then soon proved right. Within months, insurrection is breaking out all over in the country of Afghanistan. And in March 1979, a resistance group called, they then declared a jihad against the current regime of Kabul at the time. In the same month, more than 100 Soviet citizens living in Herat are seized and killed. Meanwhile, the two Khalq leaders are themselves at loggerheads. In September 1979, the president, who's Taraki, he attempted to assassinate his prime minister, Amin. Instead, within 2 days, Taraki is in the hands of Amin's supporters. 3 weeks later, he dies of a serious illness. That's according to the official announcement it was given. Since 1978, the Soviet-USSR presence has been gradually increasing in Afghanistan. Their most recent puppet state, which they have taken over, I would call it, and potentially a prestigious scalp in the Cold War. Now, the anarchy of late 1979, Moscow, Russia decides that to take a more active role. And in December, the Soviet troops move into Kabul. As Britain has always feared, Russia finally bids to control Afghanistan. And as Britain long ago discovered, this is the most unwise ambition. Then you have the Soviet occupation, which was between 1979 to 1989. You have the communist prime minister, which is Hafizullah Amin, is either shot or commits suicide within a day of the Soviet invasion. And in his place, the Russian brings Barak Karmal from Moscow, who was, as we know, he was then in exile in Moscow. They bring him back and they put him as their ruler. So he's one of their guys as a ruler now. But ruling Afghanistan in those circumstances proved impossible. Russian tanks could take any town, and the Russian planes could bomb even remote valleys in contemporary submission. But as soon as the focus of military might shifts elsewhere and the guerrillas return to take control on the ground, only Kabul remained a relatively safe area. And in 10 years of devastation, and it was only Kabul that they could be in. The rest of it was a bit difficult for them. Obviously, there was guerrilla warfare that was taking place, especially in the mountains that we know of now. And once the USA began supplying the guerrillas with Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, even the Soviet air attacks became dangerous missions. So now, you've got the Soviets who's ruling, you have the USA who's now supplying the arms to the guerrillas in Afghanistan. The most striking Soviet achievement is inadvertently persuading 7 Afghan guerrilla groups to come together in a common cause. And in 1985, as close as 1985, these 7, they were meeting in Peshawar, they form a united front as the Islami Etihad Afghanistan Mujahideen. And then the Mujahideen become famous throughout the world as the latest manifestation of the Afghan fighting spirit. The warfare between Russia and the Mujahideen not only devastates an already poor country, it also depopulates it. Eventually, some 2 million refugees flee into Pakistan and another 1.8 million into Iran. When Mikhail Gorbachev comes and he came into power in Soviet Union in 1985, the festering sore of Afghanistan is one of the urgent problems confronting him. And he attempted first a political solution, replacing the useless Babrak Karmal with a former chief of police, Muhammad Najibullah. Najibullah then proved equally ineffective in reconciling the Afghan people to a Soviet presence. And in 1988, Gorbachev decided to cut his losses. He announced that the Soviet troops will begin a phased withdrawal. That was in 1988. The last battalion crosses the Friendship Bridge over the Amu Darya River in February 1989, leaving President Najibullah to try and run the communist Afghan state on his own. So in 1989, Russia could see that they could not win that war, and they withdrew from Afghanistan. As we know the history of that part, they had to withdraw from Afghanistan. So as we can see the history of Afghanistan, there was fights for Afghanistan for a very long time. But then we had the civil war, which was from 1989. And you had it was contrary to the expectations. Najibullah contrives to he remained in power for 3 years, holding at bay the Mujahideen. But in 1992, Kabul, it fell into the opponents, and he secured the promise of a safe passage from the UN forces, who proved unable to escort him out of the city, but he was given asylum in a UN compound in Kabul. Then, from 1994, the most significant group in present-day Afghanistan emerges unheralded, without fanfare. And that was the Taliban that came in. A mullah in Kandahar, Muhammad Umar Akhund, commonly known as Mullah Umar, forms a group which he calls the Taliban. And it was a Sunni group. It was based on the Sunni students of the Quran. And in the violence and chaos of Afghanistan, the Taliban inevitably became the guerrilla group, and compared to the blatant self-interest of some certain Mujahideen, the Taliban's simple message of Islam proved immensely attractive. Recruiting mainly among the Pathan tribesmen in the east of the country and from the refugee camps in Pakistan, and the Taliban gained rapid in numbers and in strength. But when they came in, when they took over, what they did was they destroyed all the poppy plantations, they destroyed all wrongdoing in the country, whatever wrongdoing was taking place, they destroyed that. That was the Taliban as we know it. And that was what the world could not see at the time. And it then became, obviously, now as we know where it stands today, unfortunately, it becomes a very, very difficult issue. And that's what happened with Afghanistan. But as a place to tour, although it wasn't a first world country, but it was a peaceful place to go and visit Afghanistan. Currently, there are people that are going to visit Kabul, although it's a city which lots of people are afraid to go to. But just to visit, there is one hotel in Kabul, so if you want to go even, you can go. There is one hotel you can visit. When you visit in Kabul, you can go to Kabul and stay in the one hotel. Visit and see the places around. People are still humble. The Afghan people were the most humble people that we know of. And their humility is still in place. So if you want to visit, you can go. I think there are flights going from Pakistan going to Kabul, or you can go by road also, but which will be a bit dangerous. But you can go into Kabul, so you can visit if you wish, inshallah. If there is somebody that's been recently, you may contact me, give me some details. I'd like to get some information. I am busy compiling lots of information on Afghanistan, which I've been doing for the past 7 days, 8 days now. And I'm just looking into Afghanistan itself as a country. So if you do have information, please mail it to me on Mohammed, M-O-H-A-M-E-D, @globetrotting.co.za. I'd like to compile lots of information regarding the same. Next week, inshallah, I probably have Spain online. I'm busy with them, trying to see if we can get Spain to come and talk to us about
tourism in Spain. It looks like it's quite positive so far. I'm just confirming with them if the ambassador is available or if we have somebody else that's going to be available for us to speak to. So let us see what we can do, inshallah. But I'm trying to get Spain in for next week, inshallah. For myself, Muhammad Lambat, until next week, same place, same time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.